Roll to record. And a 3, 2, 1.
I've got a dog, he's called Fred. My dog is alive, he's not dead. I love my dog, he loves me too. I haven't got a cat, only a dog.
My dog, my dog, my dog, my dog. I've got a dog, I love my dog. He's my dog, he's not your dog. If you want a dog, it's your own.
Welcome, everybody, to episode 245 of the Metabolist 2 podcast, which features David
and Ben. And Ben, we have new Doctor Who.
Whoa, new Doctor Who? What?
Yeah.
I can't believe it.
Not one.
When did that happen?
Two episodes dropped over.
Two new episodes of a brand new season. Season one, I believe, is what we're watching now.
Season one on Disney, yes.
Yeah, season one on Disney. I don't know what season you're up to now.
It'd be 14 if we were counting the previous run on BBC proper, but I guess this is now Disneyfied to Doctor Who, and we are starting over at number one.
Number one. We're all wearing our Mickey Mouse ears. Mm-hmm.
And the sad thing is, when they drop two stories at once, we're already a quarter of the way through season one.
Really? That is a sobering statistic you've just produced there.
Yeah. Oh,
okay, quarter way through already, and we've only just begun.
Yeah, but two episodes, and I guess first one is Space Babies. And
Space Babies.
What did you think?
It does exactly what it says on the tin. There's some babies, and they're in space. What did I think? Goodness. I thought it was, well, I think my first thought is that it was interesting that RTD, even in his second form, is keeping to his standard sort of syntax of the way he structures things. Is the first episode, Church and Ruby Road, we'll count that as the first episode of this season, is a Earthbound story. Yep. Then you have an outer space story, and then you have a story set in the past. And he's always done that, I think, from the very beginning. So this is really the one that's set in outer space.
Yep.
So it is similar to the one that comes after Rose, which I'm blanking on the name of.
End of the World.
End of the World. Yes, it is. It is. It's End of the World. And even down to basically the same scene.
Yeah, with the window opening.
With the window opening, there's some babies in tanks, which is different rather than scary robot spiders. But yeah, and Ruby Sunday phones her mum. Before that, I mean, there's some extra stuff. We go back into dinosaur times, as far as I remember. But what did I think overall? It was okay. I found it a little bit. It moves at a fair old pace, which is, I think, only to be expected. And I think you and I are just going to have to live with that now, I think, as this is the speed of Who at this point. I thought it was interesting that something that ostensibly is like now being made for an international audience, and by international audience I mean American audience, or you know, is on the Disney Channel and has a bunch of Disney money in it. We are told a lot. The plot revolves around two words that aren't really of use in American English. So that's bogies and nappies. So I thought that was kind of interesting. If I was like a raw American living in, you know, I don't know, Des Moines or somewhere, and I was like, oh, this looks good. What is bogey? What's that? Nappies? What are those? Do they not mean diapers? So I thought that was kind of interesting, that for all the complaints one reads online, that this is being Disneyfied, etc., etc., etc. Certainly language-wise, slang, it's not really slang, English versus American English-wise, it is not being Disneyfied at all. It is still very much English. So those are two.
Yeah.
What were your first? I mean, you're aware of a bogey, right?
Yeah.
Are you? Yeah.
Briggs. Raymond Briggs had the Bogeyman book.
Oh, Fungus the Bogeyman. Indeed.
Yeah.
I did not even think of Fungus the Bogeyman. Of course. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So I think in the U.S., I've always heard it as the Boogeyman.
The Boogeyman. So Booger probably fits well then if it was.
Yeah. But I mean, there's no. Ooh, there's no double O. So bogey, I think, would probably be the correct pronunciation, but
yeah,
boogeyman is way I've heard it. So I don't think that's quite the stretch. What did I think? I thought it went by really quickly. There wasn't really anything egregiously bad with it. It's just sort of like, this is where we are, and I'm watching something that's geared towards someone born 10, 15 years, 20 years ago, maybe, someone who's in their 20s.
My grandchildren, right.
I'm at the point where the companions are younger than my own children. So that's, right. You know, it used to be I'd always look for the doctor who's older than me. Now it's sort of like, well, it'd be nice to have companions that are...
Graham, right.
Older than my children, but no, my youngest is 22 now, so... Yeah, I am not the target audience for this, and I had very low expectations going in, and I could watch it. I didn't have the feeling of dread of, this isn't very good. I had the feeling of, yeah, this is doing what it needs to do. It's introducing the series
right.
to a new generation of audiences. It's kind of hitting on the high points. It's leaning heavy into Gatwa's own background of having escaped Rwandan genocide.
Right, refugee.
It seemed like the flashbacks when the doctor was thinking about how the bogeyman was unique and the only one. It is establishing his character pretty well, but it seems in a way dumbed down Doctor Who in some ways. It seems very... We are going to be very explicit, and we're not going to leave anything for interpretation. We're just going to tell you what's going on.
Yeah, and I think, I mean, there were a couple of moments where, you know, it could have segued into something, you know, more adult, maybe the wrong word, but something more contemporary issues. You know, there was they touched on the kind of abortion things, like, you know, they
you couldn't turn off the baby machine. But you could abandon babies.
You kind of, but when they're born, they don't want to look after them, which seemed to me,
right,
the kind of U.S. abortion debate, like in a nutshell. It's like, you got to have a baby, and we care about the baby when it's in the womb, but when it comes out, it's we don't care about it at all. The refugee thing, I think, again, that could have been something, could have become something bigger, and obviously it's a huge hot-button issue in the U.K., asylum for refugees, and mm-hmm. of course the border in the US.
Yep.
So that could have happened, but I mean, it didn't. It was running through the rules, which I thought was kind of interesting. Ruby steps on a butterfly, and mm-hmm. the entire course of human evolution is changed mm-hmm. until the doctor remembers that he has to engage a special switch in the TARDIS that makes sure that that doesn't happen, which I think...
A brand new MacGuffin.
A brand new thing. Okay, that's why that doesn't happen, which I think is, you know, okay, good. And then we have had the language thing, like, how can I understand? How can I read what's going on? Well, mm-hmm. TARDIS, blah, blah, blah. Right. So, yeah, establishing the rules, I think that's helpful.
Pretty heavy, though, with, oh, Ruby, I can't bring you back to the day you were born. Absolutely, positively can't. And you know that's going to happen in the final two episodes. It just seemed to be telegraphing it very, very strongly that this is what's going to happen.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, as soon as RTD says that something can't happen, then you absolutely know that it will. Mm-hmm. So, you know, it's like, okay, why are you even bothering to say that? I mean, I think in some ways it was sort of a nice slight call back to Father's Day yeah. where, you know, if I take you back, it's a bad thing. So, but I mean, I think fingers crossed we're going to see a Reaper again. I don't think we're going to see a Reaper again. I'm hoping we're going to.
It'll
see
be a Vela. It'll be a Chronivore or whatever. It'll be Ramsay.
It'll be Ramsay. Yeah, it's just Ramsay. the time vulture. we're the only people who are still trying to make Ramsay happen. I mean, it was interesting to see they had Mavity on the
yes.
screen. So there you go. There's that.
But I think with the Mavity, that it is calling out that the rules are different. This isn't our Earth. Something is slightly off, something slightly different. It is not the same rules that we have. It's not quite the same Earth timeline that the audience, you and I, are watching from.
So I mean, I've seen online discussions about that, especially as replied to the next episode, mm-hmm. that we are in some kind of constructed universe, something to do with the toy maker, where things aren't running exactly how you might want them to run, et cetera, et cetera. I mean, maybe we can touch on that when we get on to the Devil's Cord.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not that keen on babies. Babies are fine.
It was kind of a coincidence. I wonder if that's why it debuted this weekend, because it's Mother's Day weekend in the U.S., not, of course, in the U.K., but I'm wondering if that had...
Maybe, yeah, maybe.
...some kind of coincidental timing.
My lovely wife is very keen on babies, so she was pleased to see babies involved. I was expecting to be more like Boss Babies than Baby Babies, if you see what I mean. Like... things that look like babies but are adults, if you see what I mean.
Right.
But they were mysteriously babies but who talked like babies. So basically just babies then, right. Which is fine.
The timeline that the space had been abandoned for 6 years and these babies had stunted development, I'm not sure I follow that at all.
No.
I would have made them maybe kids, but maybe making them kids would have been even harder. It seemed to me that what I would have done differently is I would have had 6 years of kids. So the oldest kids, Poppy, would have been a six-year-old.
Right.
And she would have been the captain. But yet there was still more babies coming. And perhaps right. there would be like 50, 100 kids all from 6 years down to birth. And they were struggling.
Yeah.
Like the artwork on the wall, the graffiti, kid graffiti on the wall, made no sense to me at all.
Because babies couldn't do that.
Right.
But I guess, well, I mean, they didn't seem to have the ability to lean out of their pushchairs or prams, whatever they're called, strollers, yeah. and do that.
Or construct the weird apparatus.
How does that get constructed?
Right.
It literally doesn't make sense. Babies on a spaceship. Yeah, I guess what I'm saying is, yes, they could have pushed it to make more sense, mm-hmm. but it is babies on a spaceship. So, I mean, how much sense do you really want it to make at this point? I mean, I guess, you know, in some ways you would, what I was going to say, you took, you know, that Star Trek episode where they go to the planet of the children, and everyone's a child or something.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, I think as soon as you have like a range of young people who are under 10, you get into the kind of Chitty Chitty Bang Bang, Child Catcher, you know, Oliver Twist area, which has kind of been done. You know, there's an Artful Dodger who's in charge.
Right.
So to have them just basic babies, I guess what I'm seeing here is that you know, Russell wanted to do something involving babies in space and was trying to make it work. And it works fine enough as long as you don't try and examine the concept of babies in space.
Yeah.
It wasn't a science fiction concept. There's nothing to back it up here. It's just, here are some babies.
Mm-hmm.
The only thing I would have changed, as I said, if you're going to, you know, do CGI to make their mouths move so they can actually speak English, mm-hmm. have them be sound like adults. That would be weird and cool, rather than just having them sound like regular, you know, what I would count as being a baby or a toddler of some kind.
Mm-hmm. Mm. Yeah, and RTD... again, leans into the fart agenda with the whole space station's bottom that looks like a bottom that releases a big cloud of dark methane.
Dark methane. It's like evil methane. Yeah. I mean, I was hoping that would be set on fire in some kind of way to be more like a spaceship.
Mm-hmm.
But it was just like a cloud that came out. I'm not sure it's going to help, to be honest, to get them to where they want to go.
Well, it's enough propulsion and there's no resistance. So I assume that they're going to crash into
the planet,
wherever they're going.
Whatever that is. What, again, I thought was kind of interesting is that obviously there is something going on with this actor. There's something going on with Susan Twist because we very definitely paused and held when she was on the screen being someone.
Yeah.
So, which I thought that was kind of a shame. It's really being signaled that there's something going on here with that woman.
It's Ruby's mother.
It's someone. It's Susan.
Well, the actor's name is Susan Twist, so perhaps.
Indeed, exactly, yeah. But, you know, she's been in thrice.
She's been in all of them, right?
She's been in all of them, yeah. All of them as a different person. Though, it was pointed out to me apparently in... Church on Ruby Road, where she's shouting out to them to play a particular tune. That tune is something from the 16th century, so it's like she's, oh, there's something weird going on. Anyway, so I thought that was a shame that we had that was kind of signaled so heavily as in a kind of very strong kind of bad wolf sort of way. But you know, if this is if this is going to be kind of broad brush RTD, then, you know, obviously we've got an arc going on here with the church on Ruby Road and orphans and mysterious robed figures, babies.
Yeah.
I guess this was it was. I don't think it was a very strong season opener, but certainly looking at my Disney Plus screen, this isn't the season opener. Church on Ruby Road is the season opener.
Right.
So, you know, it's the, maybe it's the not so good second episode is what we're looking at.
This is the explain all the ground rules story, not a heavy plot. Establish
right.
more of the Doctor's character, establish that Ruby is clever because she's the one who thought that this is a storybook, and of course it's the bogeyman
right.
underneath. And
yeah.
Just, I think basically in a Disney simplified way, establish the ground rules. It's kind of bright, it's colorful, it's spunky, it snaps along, there's not much to it. It's kind of cotton candy Doctor Who.
I think in some ways it is quite similar to The End of the World, with two main differences. One, it didn't have that sense of grandeur and expanse that I think The End of the World had. Murray Gold is way too far up in the mix as far as I'm concerned. He really needs to be either quieter or less busy. And it didn't have some, you know, maybe I'm being nostalgic for 2005 here, but, you know, it didn't have an iconic character like Lady Cassandra, and it didn't have an iconic moment like the Doctor is grooving along to a jukebox playing Britney Spears, which are two pretty solid, like iconic New Who moment. So we're not getting that yet, and maybe I'm too optimistic that we're going to get sort of, you know, iconic moments so early in the run. But we had iconic moments early in the run for 2005. Maybe it takes time for these iconic moments to develop. I don't know, but I wasn't seeing anything that was really kind of stopping me in my tracks. I mean, the bogeyman was kind of bogeyman, whatever he's called, was kind of reminding me of the eye goo monster from
Sleep No More.
Yeah, which is, okay, it's another thing made up of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe the whole storybook thing is building into this idea that this is all a story, some kind of storybook universe. I don't know. Anyway.
I don't know. I think we do have attempts at these memorable moments, but they're more on the lines of the Doctor talking to Victoria in Tomb of the Cybermen, like when the Doctor is talking to Poppy, like how you're
right.
special because you're unique and you're the only one in the universe. So it seemed more for the clip reel, see the emotional range and depth of this and how we're all special and everyone's unique. And it just really seemed geared towards kids, which is Doctor Who, you know, and that's what it is. And there's, and
sure.
I think it has to move along at such a place because of, you know, you're competing with TikTok, you're competing with YouTube videos.
Right,
everything is,
right.
You know, it was a complaint back, you know, when I was a kid, everyone was dumbed down because of commercials. I think it's even more fragmented and harder to concentrate. It's candy Doctor Who. It's just really sweet, and there's very little plot, if there's any plot at all.
Yeah.
It just seems to be a tunnel, a story tunnel that they go through.
I mean, I thought it was interesting and sort of indicative in that sort of way that, you know, the Doctor, instead of ejecting a literal bogeyman from the airlock and into deep space where it will die, hopefully, he didn't do that. He wanted to save it, which I can see why that's a thing that we do now, that, you know, everyone is special and there are no monsters. Monsters are just,
beings we haven't met
yet. Beings we haven't met yet. That's going to be a real problem going down the line with Doctor Who, because, like, defeating evil is kind of what we do. And if we defeat evil, there's got to be some evil things. And they've got to be things we don't like. And they've got to have something that makes them obviously something that we don't care for. So I'm interested to see what they do there, to be honest. The poor old bogeyman couldn't help being ugly and made out of
snot
bogeys. But still, like, it's just a creature that's fictional and it's made out of, like, snot, as you put it quite accurately. Why not let it die in the frozen vastness of space? Smart.
Yeah. I guess for me is it was broken down. It was sort of like it was pre-digested. It was broken down into very easily consumed,
like something you might feed a baby.
Baby food, yes. And there wasn't anything new for longtime viewers. Like, even the snot scene reminded me of The Beast Below when Amy was being in the mucus of the space whale, or
right.
the farts with the Slitheen, or the key. Obviously, RTD didn't want to prolong giving Ruby the key like he did with Martha. And it just, it, and setting the rules, and don't go back to your critical day in your past, like in Father's Day. And it just seemed like this is all retread Who, and it's very easy to consume because it's familiar and it's bright and it's colorful and it moves along at a nice pace. So it seemed like a Red Nose Day skit more than anything else. It's just light.
Yeah, it is Curse of the Fatal Death, basically, which had fart jokes in it, as far as I remember. So yeah, I think that's a pretty accurate way of formulating it, actually. I was not particularly impressed. Production values obviously high. We've got some CGI dinosaurs. Space looks really good. I mean, I guess we substituted staring at space for space looking really awesome, and then we quickly cut away to something more interesting. Mm-hmm. Acting is fine. I mean, Chuti Gatwa is a very charismatic young gentleman. I find Millie Gibson a little bit generic at this point.
Yep. I'm not feeling it.
I'm not feeling her. I'm going to get cancelled for that. No, I'm not. I'm not feeling her. She doesn't seem to have a reality that Rose had. And again, maybe I'm just being nostalgic for, 20 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
She's got a mother. She's a foster child, slightly different. Where they live, Ruby's family, it's so obviously Cardiff. It's like, this isn't London. And that kind of irks me a little bit. It's so obviously not London. That you wonder why they didn't just like, she lives in Cardiff, she's Welsh.
Hmm.
Just do that. I mean, there's an immediate character right there. She's a Welsh girl. Woman, sorry. So I'm not feeling her character. Mm-hmm. I mean, she's feisty and she's blonde.
Not sure the blonde works for her very well, actually.
Yeah, I mean, obviously if the doctor isn't blonde, then the companion has to be blonde at this point. Mm. And she's up for it. But,
is your companion a gore?
I'm going to keep on apologizing for being nostalgic for 2005. We've established that this doctor is a doctor without baggage. He's a joyful doctor who's been released from his angst and his freedom and his, doesn't have a job and blah, blah, blah. That's great, but we don't have any of the shade that Eccleston brought to the role as an amazing actor that Eccleston is, and all doctors have brought to the role, all contemporary doctors have brought to the role. I have to say, I really connected with what you said a few minutes ago, is that you didn't have the feeling of dread that you had when it's been really bad. And you're right, I did not have the feeling of dread that I had when I watched some of the Chibnall era Who's. That mm-hmm. kind of like, oh God, this is literally not good. This is literally, as you said, something that's spun out of sugar candy. I mean, maybe they should have had like a group of children under a mountain, like it's Chitty Chitty Bang Bang and there's a sweet factory and maybe some Willy Wonkas came in. I don't know. Anyway, whatever. But yeah.
Maybe that's Dot and Bubble.
Maybe. Willy and Wonka. So yeah, I mean, fine. And I think, increasingly we're going to have to say this isn't for us. But maybe the spinoffs that, mm-hmm. that Russell is promoting currently, maybe they'll be for us. Who knows? Maybe there'll be a sexy Cyberwoman for us somewhere down the line.
Well, two final thoughts on Space Babies for me.
Space Babies. Space Babies, yeah.
Yeah. First one is, it kind of ends on the same sort of beat that Moffat was doing when he was doing the TARDIS, doing the DNA scanning of Amy, trying to figure out, is she pregnant or isn't she pregnant? And once again, the doctor is trying to DNA scan Ruby, which... kind of in this age of privacy violations, and it does seem a little creepy a little bit.
Yeah, doctor.
And second thought, or the final thought, is I wonder, due to the lightness of this, that Disney and RTD and BBC thought we better release Devil's Chord, which may be a little meatier, I guess we'll talk about in a few, than just having this sit out there and having podcasters and fans and forum users and people on social media just sit and vent about it for a week with not having the counterbalance of the Devil's Chord.
I guess, but that would imply that they didn't realize what they were making until they made it and then went like, oh shit, this is a bit light. We're going to have to release the next one. That may be a factor. I think it's simply streaming. I think this is to do with US streaming. And I think certainly my lovely wife hates, or has come to hate, streamers who do not release everything at once. She is a huge release everything at once, watch it all at once person. Mm. I like being an episode of the week person.
It sure makes podcasting a lot easier.
It certainly makes our job a lot easier, let's face it, David. So, I mean, I think what they're doing is like, yeah, okay, we could release these all at once. We're not going to. But, I mean, this is a possibility that we're holding out maybe further down the line that, you know, Doctor Who can be the similar kind of flash in the pan. That, you know, Fallout or something is that like it's all comes down in one giant glob and you watch it in one day and then it's on to the next thing, which I don't think is a very healthy way to consume media, but that's just me.
Did you and Amanda watch it all, both episodes back to back?
We did back to back.
Yep. So did Rita and I. So yeah. there you go.
Yeah. Well, okay. So that's Space Babies. Not an auspicious second episode from our perspective. I'm just gonna summarize.
Well, certainly the Beatles, the Devil's Chord. Having the Beatles in any episode is going to elevate it.
I thought Disney owned who owns the Beatles nowadays? I'm so confused about the Beatles. I thought Disney owned the Beatles. I thought they bought the Beatles from Michael Jackson.
Yeah, Get Back is on the Disney Channel, so they must have Beatles rights.
But I mean, big disappointment for me here is like just even have a little bit of Beatles in there.
They did.
Did they? Which little bit of Beatles did they have?
The final chord. It's from the A Day in the Life.
Is that the chord?
The final chord.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, that's the final chord.
I think at that point I was like, okay, this is just going to be some kind of random chord. I mean, I'm so musically illiterate.
Yeah, I mean, that's why it's McCartney and...
So it's that kind of...
Lennon.
Chord.
It's that big final chord at the end of Sergeant Pepper's.
Right, okay. Yeah. Well, good. Excellent. Well, that's a very small amount of Beatles. Perfect.
So they did have some Beatles then.
Yeah.
I think they also had echoes of Beatles song, but the whole point, I guess Russell's whole ennui of this is music has gone away from the world since 1925. And so the Beatles are trying to sing the lamest Beatles Murray Gold could come up with. And it's about the dog, my pet dog.
Which we both thought was really super funny and worked really, really well.
Then it did what it needed to do.
And I also like then we segue straight into Cilla Black, who again is like a potentially kind of a deep cut for Americans, but there you go.
Very much so.
Straight into Cilla Black, also not really doing a good song. I would have then enjoyed if they'd then gone into like Jimi Hendrix or someone and he's just kind of... plinkety plonkety plinketing his guitar. Obviously, 1963, Jimi Hendrix wasn't doing his thing at that point.
No, it wasn't.
Certainly not. Mm-hmm. Abbey Road, he wasn't. But I mean, I wish they could have thought of someone similar. It's like some kind of virtuoso. I mean, maybe, I don't know, Yehudi Menuhin or something.
They could have had the Stones.
Or the Stones. It would have been fun to have the Stones instead of the Beatles, wouldn't it, actually?
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
What if you could swap this over for the Stones?
But you couldn't. You that final chord.
You need the final chord. Yeah, that's true.
Well, also, I think it's generally thought of Lennon and McCartney as being geniuses, and I'm not sure you get that with Mick Jagger or any of the other people in the Stones.
That's a burn. if Mick is listening, Mick, I'm sorry. I know you're a regular listener. David didn't mean that. No, he did.
I mean, I'm just going with popular culture. I think the Beatles are always elevated over the Stones. Rather, you know, the Stones are a long-lasting touring band that have had a great cultural impact. However,
They're not the Beatles.
I think the Beatles are elevated on a pedestal at this point. They're mythic.
So I would have gone to Jacqueline Dupre or Yehudi Menuhin or someone who played, you know, a good instrument really, really well in the early 60s and have them doing chopsticks or something, you know, on the piano. But, I mean, I thought that was a great scene. I thought that worked really, really well. And, I mean, in general, I really enjoyed this episode.
Very good.
You know, I thought it was good. I've already said how much I kind of disliked a Disney, you know, Mary Poppins. We had the Mary Poppins London of the future, where everything is visible, even though it's not actually visible. And to be honest, on the rooftop, we had a literal Mary Poppins London, because it's we're on the rooftop and we're looking over London. It's all smoky, Governor.
I thought it was supposed to be echoing Let It Be.
Yeah, well, again, if you're on top of Abbey Road Studio, you're not able to see St. Paul's or the Tower or Tower Bridge in the same...
It's you can not... in fantasy CGI London. Well,
exactly. And that if that was supposed to be Tower Bridge, that was a pretty poor drawing of Tower Bridge they put in there. So again, it seemed to me to be very kind of Mary Poppins-y. And I, as regular listeners to this podcast will remember, I hate Mary Poppins. Pretty much every incarnation of Mary Poppins I hate. Apart from the Alan Moore incarnation of Mary Poppins, who I do like. I mean I love their outfits. I'm glad that when they were dashing joyfully into the TARDIS wardrobe, Shooty was able to say, "And we've got wigs," because I was worried that he'd have some ability to grow his hair backwards and forwards. A new kind of Time Lord ability. Now we know it's just a wig. Excellent. I think the outfits were great. I thought it seemed like 60s London. I thought the canteen, BBC canteen style, that was good. Susan Twist turns up, also good.
Oh yeah, she was the tea lady, wasn't she?
She was one of the tea ladies, exactly.
Or in the lunchroom, not the one pushing the cart.
Lunch lady Twist or whatever she's called.
Yeah.
And you get June Hudson pops up. That's always nice to see.
So, oh yeah, she was the old lady who played piano and then the maestro obviously killed her, I guess.
It'll be nice actually if whenever they need an old lady, they just have June Hudson do it. I think that would be fun going forward. I'm sorry, I'm rabbiting on. Your immediate reactions, David, to the Lost Chord.
To the last Devil's Chord.
Devil's Chord, beg your pardon.
The maestro just owned this episode completely, end to end. It was, I think, hard for any sense of peril for me. I think the maestro was so camp, and I just didn't believe that the doctor thought that I guess the maestro is the child of the toy maker was as deadly or as dangerous as the toy maker, because I really didn't buy the Neil Patrick Harris toy maker as this great baddie, this deadly, this, you know, you get one chance type character, or you get one trick. And I just didn't get the fear, but you know, I guess he, through the script, it did explain that it split him in two, and obviously the maestro had great impact, that he was able to steal the music. She was able to steal all the music forever. Again, it just seemed very light on a story. And I think all the pieces were there really well. Like, you had Ruby playing on the roof, and you established in the church on Ruby Road that Ruby's in a band and she can play keyboards.
She can play the keyboards. Yeah,
so
yeah, yeah.
It's not like all of a sudden in Moffat Air, where Mel's appears in the second series, and oh, she's been a friend of Amy and Rory for like ever, and it's sort of like at least things have been kind of sewn pretty well. And
yeah,
I thought the story was RTD saying, "I really want to get Jinx Monsoon on here in a role, and the maestro is perfect because she has this voice and she can play it really the same kind of level that Neil Patrick Harris can play it in, and just like over the top.
Right.
And I want to have the Beatles in, and I want to use that final chord from A Day in the Life as as the counter to the devil's chord. And it's sort of like he has all these little pieces in there. And then I guess he has two dancers or two judges from Strictly.
Oh, yeah, from Strictly. Yeah, which I didn't know who they were until I saw the credits. So, yeah.
Right. And so, you know, I want to get this zeitgeist in there. And Cilla Black, obviously, is a big star in RTD's
mind.
Worldview. Or should be, you know, and, you know, she dated Paul McCartney back in the day. So, I mean,
indeed, she did. Yeah. Yeah. They should have had a bit where they're like, ooh, Cilla, ooh. Oh.
And, you know, the Beatles were Beatlesque enough.
Amanda, my lovely wife, was a huge fan of the Beatles and has all the Beatles albums. You're not as much a fan as she used to be when she was a teenager. The Beatles were the biggest thing for her. Mm-hmm. So she's quite Beatle attuned. As we all were, a little bit nonplussed by, like, those don't look like the Beatles. Mm-hmm. However, when you're not actually looking at them and they're just doing Beatley things and speaking in a Liverpool accent, mm-hmm. then I thought they were pretty good. They were Beatles adjacent, mm-hmm. if not actual Beatles.
Now, I think it's a little too catering towards, you know, 50-year-old audience to have Ruby wanting to go back to see the Beatles. That just seems a little bit of a stretch to me. I think if RTD was really into meta navel gazing, he would want to go to see Britney Spears record Toxic or something like that.
That would have been good. Or here's another idea, gone back to 1974 and see ABBA win the Eurovision Song Contest with Waterloo.
Yes.
Oh my God. Yes. And just had like some ABBA alikes do ABBA things. And I bet ABBA's music's cheaper to get a hold of than the Beatles is, as long as you're nice to Bjorn and Benny. Wow. Yeah, okay. Sorry, I'm with you with your Jinx Monsoon observations. I didn't feel any jeopardy at all from Jinx Monsoon. I'm not a follower of drag. I don't watch RuPaul's Drag Race. I'm not really interested in that whole drag thing. She very much reminded me of Divine from John Waters. And I think if they'd actually maybe done more of that, I think that would have been better. But the two things that were leaping out from me from that Jinx Monsoon performance were, one, Pantomime Dame. Mm-hmm. So it's a pantomime, and as I'm sure, again, regular listeners of our podcast will know about pantomime, and obviously in pantomime there is always a man dressed up as a woman, and that's the Pantomime Dame, and it's a figure of fun and a figure of imagined but not actual real threat. And the very extravagant costumes that Jinx was wearing, you know, with the piano keys and shit, that's Pantomime Dame right there. That's what Widow Twanky wears in Aladdin, etc., etc., etc. So that was something, and for me, that completely neuters the threat. It's like, okay, this is just someone being silly. This is not a threat of any kind. The other thing that she was really reminded me of, especially when the staves and notes were kind of circling around and wrapping people's legs up and stuff like that, mm-hmm. it actually started to remind me of 1960s Batman.
Yes, yes.
Where there's stuff in the air going like, bam, pow, and the villains are silly.
Cartoon villains.
What they are. Yeah, they really are. They're obviously, they are in the envelope of the show. They're a threat to the heroes, but they're not in any way threatening. And I couldn't see the Doctor being frightened by someone like that.
Yes, absolutely. I think 100% agree with you that this is Batman, effectively. Because with the bright colors at the end. And
the 60s thing also helps, yeah.
That was one of the things that kind of flitted briefly through my mind when I was kind of rethinking this thing. That we have a very cotton candy first episode, right, and now we have cartoon villain and cartoon type melodrama. And it did really seem like Adam West's Batman. That if this Doctor was like the Pertwee Doctor, where he's doing a Venusian Aikido or something, you could almost see the cartoon bubbles of bam, pow,
crash,
you know, zop,
bang,
right.
So yeah, you know, it's like I can't remember who played the Joker now, but you know, it's like that from Batman. You know, the guy who famously wouldn't shave off his moustache, so it really obviously when they put the Joker makeup on, like he just looked like he'd got white makeup on over his moustache. Like unconvincing, but deliberately unconvincing and cartoonish, which again, you know, maybe that leans into this idea of this being some kind of fabricated world. And obviously, the dance sequence at the end, there's a twist at the end, and then we all dance the twist, and Doctor breaks the fourth wall. Maybe that is implied there. I'll have to say, if that's the best Murray Gold can do for a twist song, that's not very good at all, because that was like, this is a really awful song. I do not know why those people are dancing so exuberantly to this. Can you not please just license Toxic or something again and just have them dance to that? Surely Chubby Checker is like cheap enough at this point that they could just do the twist.
I don't know. It served its purpose.
Yeah, I don't know why they had to write an original song there, especially if that original song literally wasn't very good.
Well, RTD obviously has wanted to do a big musical number in Doctor Who. I think that's the only reason it was there. They must have spent like 4 or 5 minutes of story time on that final reprise of the twist at the end. It's just a celebration of the Doctor Who cartoon silliness, I guess.
Yeah, I just would have liked them to dance to an actual song that we would... I mean, I don't think anyone was humming along to that song. I don't think it's going to get released as a single, you know, like they did with the song for 10, etc.
Do you think it was better or worse than the Goblins?
I thought it was considerably worse than the Goblins.
Okay.
And I didn't really like the Goblins that much. So I was disappointed. And actually, hang on, this is something that I popped in my head when we were talking about Jinx. I like music. I don't really buy the concept that if there's no music in the world is destroyed and is a big pile of ash.
Well, it drove everyone mad that they started a war for no reason. Without music, people were edgy and couldn't figure out why, and so they decided to nuke each other, and there was a nuclear winter.
Fair. I still don't think that a world without music would be so catastrophically bad that we'd all destroy ourselves in a nuclear war.
I don't know.
Okay, anyway, yeah. That didn't ring true for me. That's a nonsensical statement, because, of course, it none of it is true. I wasn't convinced that it would be that bad. And I also actually wasn't convinced that it was that easy to defeat the Maestro or Maestro. Though I suppose if Maestro is a lesser creature, that it's the child of the toy maker.
Yeah, it fits with the game of catch. You know.
Well, I didn't like the game of catch either. You know, if the Maestro is like kind of all music or something, then surely the Maestro would like love music and want people to be extra irritatingly musical and people kind of fandango themselves to death, like that kind of too much music.
Yeah, you would think it would have been the whole everyone was singing.
Yeah.
And just, yeah.
A kind of chaotic tarantella,
yeah.
You know, that kind of thing. That would have worked for me, I think, a lot better. I think it would have been harder to do, obviously. The Maestro wants to take all music inside of themselves or something.
Yeah.
But then the Beatles say, but surely the Maestro knows about the Beatles already? Because presumably the Maestro and her ilk are... you know, transtemporal in some kind of way, so they know about music from the beginning of time to the end of time. Or maybe they don't. Maybe they've never heard of the Beatles.
Well, then that's another movie that got made.
Yeah, so I guess all in all, I think, you know, like Space Babies, the more you look at it, the more it doesn't work. However, I think superficially the envelope was, for me, more satisfying than the Space Babies. The more I think about my Batman analogy, the less I like, because I don't really like 60s Batman. The more I like, maybe I don't like this either.
So I think, let's see, The Devil's Chord, Jinx, the Maestro that calls themselves them as...
Right, they do.
The pronoun.
Exactly.
So that was in there, that funny scene, I guess. I don't know.
Who are you to judge humor at this point?
Exactly. I'm just an old guy. It just seemed cartoon. It's light. It's fluffy.
There's no sense of kind of... There's no awe-inspiringness, which I think you kind of need in a spacey science fiction-y show rather than just kind of cartoon running around. And, you know, as I said, I'm not a connoisseur of drag in any kind of way. I would have really enjoyed Jinx Monsoon to play a character who was presenting as non-binary or a woman, but a serious character. It seemed to me like, okay, well, this is just a drag act, right? Which is great, and I've got nothing wrong with a drag act, but why not have someone who obviously is interested in, you know, playing fantastical characters, why not actually have them play a character of some kind?
But I think I disagree. I think they played a character. I think it was an over-the-top cartoon villain that was very melodramatic, that fits well within the toy maker
universe.
They had the little tirade about how daddy was so mean to me. There's something going on here. I'm hoping, since this is the mood that RTD is establishing, that we're going to see more of the toy maker's children, at least one more. I think for Deep, maybe that's why Moffat is coming next episode. Kind of bring in the empty child level to this, maybe with Boom. We'll have to see come next weekend.
We will. That's true. Yeah, we will. We will. Yeah.
But to me, Cotton Candy and then Batman.
Batman.
1960s Batman.
Maestro.
And they did the twist in Batman, too, I think.
The Batusi, I think. Isn't it famously?
Yeah, I think it is.
It is, famously.
They could have licensed the Batusi.
They could have licensed that. Come on. They literally could have licensed anything for less money and also more effective than the song that Murray Gold wrote. Because I think he's fine. I don't think he did a good job there. And I think I would have loved, if I'd been humming along to some awesome early 60s, like cheap to license twist song, I would have been a lot more well disposed by the end of the end of the episode.
Well, I guess they couldn't end Twist and Shout because of the Beatles version, because they already licensed that with Ferris Bueller's Day Off.
True. They already licensed that for HBO's True Detective last season.
Yeah,
which was, spoiler alert, don't watch it, it's awful.
My final thought on The Devil's Chord is there was a lot of fourth wall breaking in this story,
right,
the maestro playing the da-da-da-dun, the piano, which bled into the opening theme. And then
had the whole opening theme played on the piano. That's what they should have done.
They could have Jess in there.
They should have had Jess in there. Just turning around and smiling to the camera like on Monty Python. As he plays the theme.
But just like the whole twist at the end, like Ruby, there's something, it's sort of like audience, there's something you have to always know that it just seemed to me to be fourth wall breaking. This is Doctor Who not taking itself very seriously anymore. And it's like, maybe it's not the same as having Douglas Adams being the script editor, but it's really a tonal shift, a huge tonal shift from Moffat, from the years of Chibnall, to now we have Doctor Who doing Buffy and Batman.
It's true. However, I will say that this does not have the emptiness and kind of pit falling out of the bottom of your stomach, like awfulness of the ghost monument where they're wandering around South Africa for 45 minutes and then get attacked by some scarves and then it's over.
Right.
At least it doesn't have that. There's stuff in it and it's entertaining. It is not just simply bad. It is just different. And there's a lot of, I think, fans like us do a lot of coping here and like, oh, maybe this is all something that's going to pay off. Maybe it will all pay off. I wouldn't put money on it paying off, but fine. That's fine. It's good. Yeah.
So the question I want to park for the season to answer at the very end, are we just too old to appreciate this anymore?
No, I can appreciate. Yeah, well, let's find out. Let's find out. In the next 5 weeks, let's find out. 6 weeks.
All right.
Yeah. Goodness.
Well, thank you for listening to episode 245 of the Metabolos 2 podcast. I have been searching through the back catalog looking for some royalty-free twist music with Ben.
I have been I've been doing the Bat-Tootsie with David.
The Bat Dance.
The Bat Dance. Ooh. Oh, yeah, like in... Get some prints in there. Anyway, whatever. Yeah.
Oh, well, there you go.
There's something that's hard to license.
That's what she should have wanted to see. Go back to First Avenue and see the first live Prince concert.
The first Minneapolis-centric Doctor Who episode ever done. Yeah.
There you go.
First Avenue, man. Yeah. Where's that? Yeah.
That would have been perfect.
Yeah, and they could...
You could have them with Morris Day and the time and... Oh.
Goodness. And actually, Shooty's quite a small man. He could easily be Prince.
Hmm.
And they could have had like a double thing going on. I don't know.
Yeah, but he doesn't look... Well, he doesn't look like Prince at all.
Put him in a wig.
Stature. Height. We got... Artist has wigs.
That is wigs. And they're similar size. He's quite small, isn't it, Shooty? Or is he big? Am I...
I thought he was tall.
I think he's small. Okay, hang on. At the risk of going on for far too long, how tall is Shooty Gatwa? Let's ask the internet. He's 5'8". Though actually, he's a normal height. He's not Prince height at all. Oh, well, never mind. forget that one. All right. Yeah, cool. Thanks for listening, everybody.
Talk to you later.
Bye.
But there is one thing that I should warn you about, Ruby, and this is really very serious. With all my adventures throughout time and space, I have to tell you, there's always a twist at the end.
Bring the action.
Rock and roll. Everybody, let's lose control. All the bottom, we let it go. Going fast, we ain't going slow. No, no. Hey, yo. Hear the beat, now let's hit the flow. Drink it up and then drink some more. Light it up and let's let it blow. Blow, blow. Hey, yo. Rock it out, rock it now. If you know what we talking about, burn it up and burn down the house. Half, half. Hey, yo. Turn it up and don't turn it down. Here we go shake the ground. Cause everywhere that we go, we
bring the action.
When you hear this in the club, you gotta turn the shit up. You gotta turn the shit up. You gotta turn the shit up. When we up in the club, all eyes on us. All eyes on us. All eyes on us.
You see them girls in the club, they looking at us. They looking at us. They looking at us.
Everybody in the club, all eyes on us. All eyes on us. All eyes on us.
I wanna scream and shout and let it all out. And scream and shout and let it out. We sayin' oh, we oh, we oh, we oh. We sayin' oh, we oh, we oh, we oh. I wanna scream and shout and let it all out. And scream and shout and let it out. We sayin' oh, we oh, we oh, we oh.
Now, rockin' with Will I Am in
Britney, bitch.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, no. You gave that helmet regulator quite a twist, I'm afraid.
Oh, yeah. All right, there you go. You know, yeah, I mean, it should make for an entertaining 6 weeks of podcasting.
Yeah.
At the very least.
The first album was recorded in a one long 12-hour session. The last song to be done was a song called Twist and Shout, which nearly killed me. It was the last song after 12 hours of singing and being in a recording studio. And I was always bitterly ashamed of it because I sang it better than that, you know. But now it doesn't bother me. You can hear that I'm just some frantic guy, you know, doing his best. But it was the nearest thing to trying to capture us live, you know. The nearest thing to as we might have sounded in Hamburg or Liverpool, it's about the nearest it could get to knowing what we sounded like before we became the clever Beatles.